I'm hoping that you've read through chapter 9, maybe 10, 11, and 12, as far as that goes. I've kind of enjoyed getting into this portion of the book of Ecclesiastes. There are a lot of good points that are made, we've seen and we've discussed in the earlier chapters. But at this point, there's as we've talked about already, this kind of shift in mind thinking for Solomon and the conclusions now that he is drawing. So many of which are conclusions that are helpful to us, that we can make just some very good applications to. And so I'm kind of enjoying this part of the text more so, just because there's the application part. I enjoy that. You know, Solomon, as we have seen, has spent a lifetime searching for answers, and he looked for answers under the sun. And really and truly, he's determined that life under the sun itself offers very little. And now his scope has broadened, and he's looking at life beyond the sun, because life under the sun left him empty. That was really the issue and the problem. And so after exploring all these different philosophies and ideas in life, and having tried everything, that all of these things that left him disappointed and bewildered, realizing again that this life is temporary, until he looked above the sun and he can see that there's more. And so now he's drawing these conclusions. You know how unsatisfying life can be if all it is just material things, things that we can touch, things that we can get a hold of. That life under the sun can be very lonely and it can be very empty. I mean, here was a man who had people around him all the time. King of just a great and strong nation at that time. You know, he had servants at his beck and call. Here's a man who sounds as if he's lonely, and yet he's got 700 wives and 300 concubines, and he's lonely. I mean, this has to be, at some level at least, a miserable life. I mean, to have people at every side, all he has to do is speak and things are done, and yet he's a man that sounds at times just miserable. He's coming more and more to the conclusion once again that man needs God, that without God there's life is empty. You know, very much even in our day, in our time, we can find ourselves in such a mindset where we're going to do things our way. You know, and sometimes we're quite proud of the fact that, I did it my way. Well, in some things perhaps there's not a problem or issue with that, but God has a way that he wants and expects things done. Solomon tried it all. He did things his way, and yet still came up empty, still came up, you know, unsatisfied. It can be depressing, too, to come to the idea and the conclusion that this life's going to end. Solomon very much was aware of that. And as we get into chapter 9, you know, this, what some have called a fatalistic view of some things is very apparent. Well, you can call it fatalistic, you can call it realistic. We're going to die. And Solomon has acknowledged that and makes that point. And the bottom line being is he's finally coming to that conclusion that there is more than this. God has placed eternity into the hearts of men. And that's what gives us some reason and some level of hope. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. So I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands, but no man knows whether love or hate awaits him. All share a common destiny. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good man, so with the sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live. And afterward they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. Well, let's stop and think about some of that right there. We started in chapter 9 on Wednesday night. The days of exploring for Solomon, it seems, have come to an end. And the author is now kind of summing up life, putting some things in perspective. He's drawing conclusions here. You know, the very first verse here says, so I reflected on all of this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands, But no man knows whether love or hates awaits him. Look, he says, this, you know, this is for us. He says, I've tried all of these things. I've done all of these things. And all of the things I've tried in life, tried to find happiness and pleasure, these things, this doesn't work. Let me save you the trouble here. Let me tell you some things. He's sharing these conclusions for us. We don't have to try everything that Solomon tried. It's already been done. There's nothing new under the sun. How many times has he told us that? There's nothing new under the sun. Learn from me. And so he lays these things out for us so that we can maybe build some conclusions based on some things he has said. You've said to your children, or you've had someone say to you, you know, you don't have to try everything. You know, you can sometimes look even at the mistakes of others and learn some great and valuable lessons. We can look at the life of Solomon and we can do just that as well. And the idea here of what he says, that our life is in the hands of God. I want us to think about this for a minute. You know, he's talked so much about how, you know, the vanity of life, and concludes that, you know, that, you know, it's not like we are mindless robots just stumbling our way through life. There's more to life than that. And we have intellect, and we can make some choices, and we can make some decisions. And yet at the same time, he says in this first verse, you know, he says that our what we do is in the hands of God. Well, think about that a minute. And I want you to make some comments about that. What does it mean to be in the hands of God? I mean, does that mean we have no choices in life? He's just going to move us around? That we can't control our destiny, so to speak? What does it mean?
The first thing that comes to my mind is that God is in control, not us. We're not steering the ship. He is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what is the ship that he steered? Life. You know, and he has put life on earth with a point and with a purpose. What else? I mean, what else are we thinking? And what else can Solomon be referring to when he says that basically our life is in God's hands?
It seems that a lot of what we've just read relates to the commonness of experiences of man. And that God, in some ways at least, when we look at animals, we know that their instincts are pre-programmed in most of the things that they do, the desires that they have to, you know, reproduce or to find food or to nest in the winter or to build a web, or to, you know, all of these things are part of their instinct. And in some ways, God has pre-programmed human beings to experience certain things and to have certain needs and desires. We are born with that. So there's a lot of the things that are mentioned here that are all common to man. Yeah. And it doesn't matter who you are. You can be the president of the United States, or you can be a great king. You can be a great king, or you can be a pauper,
extreme.
A common person, whatever labels people want to put on different kind of people. But in the final analysis, whatever we do in this life, God holds it in his hands, at least in part, to be interpreted as God knows everything. He is keeping record of everything. He is accounting for everything. And in the final day, all of those things are before God's knowledge and eyes, and he will be the final judge.
That no matter who we are and what we do or accomplish in this life, we're still not going to be beyond the hands of God, that he's still in control. Isn't that amazing to think about that? Any other thoughts that you have along that line?
Joe?
Yes.
One thing I've come to realize, just being in the workforce and then also as a father, you know, you talk about we have that freedom to make choices, and we make our choices in life. You know, and then as Solomon says here, we are ultimately in the hands of God. People want to be free. They want to have that liberty to make the choices. But they do want some direction, you know, just like with children. They want boundaries. You know, they talk about mom and dad are overbearing, but they want to know those boundaries that they can go. It's the same thing in the workplace. You know, people talk about freedom to move around and go here and there, but they need that that direction. It's the same thing, I think, as a Christian. We need teaching. We need direction in life. Christ being the ultimate example of how we are to live our lives. We have still the choices. Each and every day when we get up, we can make a choice to live righteously or to do things that we know are against God's will. But I think everybody, they scream that they want to be free and independent, but yet they do want some direction. They want restrictions on things.
And yet God has provided us both. He's provided boundaries, and he's provided us freedom as well. I mean, choice is all up to us on how we're going to live this life. I mean, it has to be within a certain circle, I think, which is part of what Solomon is identifying here, you know, where God is in control. But he's given us those freedoms, you know, with the boundaries that come with that. You know, the other thing that I think about when I see that, you know, like we are in God's hands, I find some hope and comfort in that. I mean, there's nothing that we do, there's nowhere that we can go that we are beyond the will and the knowledge of God. You know, we still have choices to make, right or wrong. But regardless of what happens in this life, the hands of God are still near and close by. You know, the very idea here, too, is as well, that no man knows whether love or hate awaits him. I mean, what's going to happen tomorrow? We don't know. I mean, we don't know. And this is a point that Solomon starts to make over and over again, that we just don't know what tomorrow will bring. I mean, he has seen it happen. He's seen those who are alive today and who are not tomorrow. We've all seen that too. You know, that kind of thing will happen. It's just one of those reality checks, you know, that's brought around. You know, but we're talking now about the one, about God, who holds tomorrow in his hands. There's not one of us here that we can turn to and we can say, spare my life till tomorrow. Not one of us have the power to do that. And yet, when we bow our heads to God, we are speaking to the one who holds life in his hands. Isn't that amazing? And is that part of what Solomon is starting to see and to understand? Verse 2, when he says, all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. That common destiny is death. I mean, in life, there are so many choices, so many different paths that we can go. People can just do so many different things. But one thing we have in common, we may have little in common in this life, but one thing we do have in common, we all will die. The rich and the poor, the famous and the unknown, it doesn't matter, we are all going to die. Death is certain. That's one reality from which we cannot run. I wonder what Solomon was thinking about even with that. I mean, with such great power, I mean, he can command anything, and yet he cannot command life tomorrow. He knew that he was going to die as well. And it just seems to me in these latter chapters, you know, this is where the realization of life and death is real for him. And the power that God holds is real to him as well. Some of this we talked about Wednesday night. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it just all starts working into some things that are said here throughout the ninth chapter as we kind of go forward right here. Interesting that Solomon labels death and evil here in the text. Does it seem peculiar or out of the way to consider death as an evil? I don't think it's the only time in Scripture really that is identified that way.
Well, I think it may be the Old Testament use of the word evil here. I mean, we think of evil and we think of wickedness and sin, but I think my understanding of the word evil here is the same word that is translated sin, which is missing the mark. This is where this earthly life falls short. And that's that Solomon is identifying the problem with life under the sun.
Yeah.
It's not saying it's wicked. He's saying this is where it falls short. I think.
In view of what can be made perfect, life eternal. I mean, you see the contrast. Kind of a powerful statement in that way.
You know, in making choices in life, that's not all a choice about evil or good. There are so many choices we have to make that neither one would be a sin.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make the choice.
But which is better? We struggle with which is right.
Well, yeah, which would be, and all we can do is pray about it. Well, maybe sometimes we make the wrong choice and we look back and say, oh, I should have done this other, mm-hmm. I should have taken this other opportunity. But then the scripture says that all things work together for good.
God can use that to our benefit, sure.
So even if we make the wrong, per se, choice, mm-hmm. it's something that's not very evil, but important.
Solomon made some choices that were not the most wise choices, and some things that he did and tried. And yet he's lived long enough to be able to reflect back on that, and maybe it's something that we can learn from. I've learned from a few mistakes in life, more than my share, I think. But, you know, sometimes you learn from those things. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all, verse 3. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterwards they join the dead. What would life be without God? It seems to be part of the idea right here. I mean, without God, there would be no standard of living. You know, standard of, as of, you know, what is right and what is wrong. You know, man can do evil things with no remorse when there is no standard, when he rejects God. You know, you can destroy your conscience in such a way where you don't regret sin when our conscience is seared. And yet on the other hand, we've read that God sets eternity in the hearts of men, and that we should know something about right or wrong. We know something about looking for God. And here is Solomon saying, you know, he knows that he will die, and we seemingly, even the most unreligious recognize that they will die, and some even fear facing God. Not all acknowledge that, but many do. They know there is something more than this life, and that seems to be what Solomon is coming to. But there's more than this life. Verses 4 through 6 kind of start painting that picture then, when he says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better than a dead lion. That's a weird phrase to me. And I'm still not sure I really have a grasp of that. But here we're talking about living and death. That's the context. You know, and here's it. I mean, when you think about if you could say the majesty of a dog or a lion, which kind of stands up ahead? Which is kind of revered? I mean, I can be scared of a dog sometime, but I'd be much more scared of a lion. You know, the power. And then, you know, there are some pretty dogs, but there's just something majestic about a lion.
The king of beasts.
What's that? The king of the beasts. That's right. Not a dog, you know. And so the comparison he's making, even a live dog is better than a dead lion. This comparison here about, you know, life and death. You know, that if you're alive, even if you're a dog and you're alive, you're still alive. And there's still some hope in that way. When you're dead, you know, you have no longer that hope of life here, physical life. You know, in verse 5, it goes, it's the same thought. Verse 5, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, or I think some texts might say they have no further life. And even the memory of them is forgotten. You know, the dead have no part in this world anymore. I mean, they're gone. I mean, we can drive by a cemetery and we see a lot of tombstones there, but they have no part of this world anymore. Their life is gone. I think that's the idea here of what Solomon is trying to reflect for us here. You no longer share in the hope of life when you have breathed your last. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, once you have breathed your last and you have died and been separated from this earth, you have no more opportunity. There's nothing else you can do about your
destiny. Can't change this life.
No, once that seals it, it's done. There's nothing more as far as making a decision towards your eternal life.
Yeah. It's done. Verse 6, he goes on and says this, their love, their hate, their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun.
That's your perspective.
It's right. Here's your perspective. And this is Solomon's perspective of some things as it's all kind of coming together. And we need to get a hold of that too. That as far as life under the sun goes, and I think that's an imperative right there. As far as life under the sun goes, when we die, life under the sun is gone. Under the sun. That's right.
Whatever influence we're going to have in our family, whatever words of the Lord come out of our mouths to our work fellows at work or school, whatever we are going to do in this life, we had better get on with it.
Yeah.
Because there is no, it says right here, there's no memory of them when they're dead. And that's really true. You know, I don't need
to. It's a sad truth.
I knew my grandfather and my grandmother. They have nothing to do with my life at this point.
Right.
Other than getting me here.
That's right.
And then farther back than that, what does any of the greatest figures in history have very little to do with what I do every day?
Mm-hmm. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And some, when you look back through history, there are some who are great people of prominence and power and position. And yet, how do they affect our lives directly today? No. They're gone. They're dead. And it's kind of a powerful thing you wrap that up.
I think he's still talking here about under the sun. He's, mm-hmm. Basically, I think what he's saying is, without God, when we die, we know nothing. We're forgotten. Mm-hmm. We're no better than an animal that dies if God is out of the picture.
Right.
I think that's the point.
Yeah. Yeah, this is very much the comparison of God, who holds all things in his hands, and the power of God, compared to any power, anything we see in this life, no matter how powerful we are, we're still going to die. What is that compared to what God holds in his hands? It's nothing. And so now we're getting into a point in the text where there's going to be more and more said. Really, I think that the reference becomes stronger about what we have in God and what we have in this life. And in reality, if we have everything that's to be offered in this life of monetary things, it's nothing as compared to what we lose when we're separated from God.
But if we know God, we won't be forgotten.
Yeah, that's another good point.
Yeah.
And
in the spiritual realm, when we die, we don't pass in this life to the next not knowing anything. When we get to the other side, we are going to be aware.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're going to stand before God.
And most importantly, even though there are those of great power and prominence of the past that we don't even really know, they have vanished from this life, when we die from this life, if we are the people of God, who knows us? God. That's all that matters. And that's a pretty powerful point in itself when you think about that. Look a little bit farther. Let's see. I wouldn't read verse 6, I don't think. Their love, their hate, their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have any part in anything that happens under the sun. We've kind of discussed that. Looking at verse 7. Go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart. For it is now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white, and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. So now why is he saying, go eat your food with gladness, have a joyful heart? I mean, he has said so much up to this point about, you know, this life's really not much. No matter how much you have, you're just going to die. So what's the idea now as he's saying, you know, eat your food, you know, drink your wine, have a joyful heart. Is it a mind shift here? What's going on?
God has provided so many good things for us, and if we are following his life, we can enjoy.
We can enjoy. Well, he's talked before about the work of your hands.
And I know people today, you know, who don't want to recognize God, don't want to have anything to do with him. But what joy do they have? I'll get a bigger paycheck or something, but that's about all they can live over to. Do they go home and enjoy life with their wife? No. Mm-hmm. They're out running around looking for something even better.
Yeah.
And they just miss the joy that a Christian who is following in God's ways.
There can be some simple joys that bring great satisfaction.
Absolutely.
Bless.
Well, along with his point, Solomon is, he's showing us the flip side a little bit. He's giving us a little, after all these things that seem very pessimistic and very negative, he's saying at the end, and he'll do that at the very end,
mm-hmm.
he'll say, here's the other side of this.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's all vanity, mm-hmm. even though it's all meaningless, even though it seems all worthless, there is still some pleasures to be had here in this life. And that you should take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
He says, don't let your mm-hmm. head go without ointment.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let, and wear white, and eat, and enjoy what God has provided for you.
We don't have to be wearing clothes of mourning all the time. I think that's the idea.
Yeah, that's right.
Wearing the white,
right.
You know, he's being uplifted. Sister Carter.
I don't think the whatever condition or situation you find yourself in, maybe you don't have money, maybe you don't have a family, maybe you're never did much in the work world, you can still find that peace and joy mm-hmm. beyond all understanding because it's from the inside out, not the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And
attitude has a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
And that seems to be part of what he's saying right here. You know, you can be, by the world standards, quite poor, and yet find some great satisfaction in some of the simple blessings of life. You know, you don't have to have, here as he's saying, eat your food with gladness. There's a thought that just came to my mind here. I mean, we think sometimes about just a great fare, a great table spread with all kinds of food. I mean, none of us are too unhappy or shy to pull up to a table such as that and just enjoy that and find some great gladness in doing that. There's a thought that comes to my mind of being handed an ear of corn in Africa. And we're not even talking about sweet corn here. We're talking about cow corn, as I'll call it. And just field corn, that some of the brethren had grown. And there was a reason for joy because everybody had a ear of corn to eat. And there was great gladness in that. Just a perspective check here, reality check. There was a reason to find joy in that. Joy can be found at different levels, can't it?
I think it almost goes to the old glass half empty, glass half full mentality. Mm-hmm. Solomon has focused us a lot on the glass half empty part throughout Ecclesiastes. That there's a lot of negative to dwell on. And even when we sit down at a Thanksgiving feast, we can feel guilty about that because of the ear of corn in Africa. But God, I think he's saying you don't need to do that. You need to enjoy the life that God has given you. Well, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And not focus on the negative so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Frank, go ahead.
I think the telling is to live for today and tomorrow will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
I've eaten some of that corn you're talking about. Put a little sugar in it, it's pretty good.
You have to dress it up a little bit.
I don't think when Solomon was doing all these things that he's referenced here, I don't think he felt the way he feels here. I think he's a pretty happy guy when he was doing all these things. Sometimes we think that, rich people aren't happy or worldly people aren't happy. Well, I've met some that are.
Yeah.
Difference is that happiness is very transient.
Mm-hmm.
Something's got to keep continually taking its place.
Yeah.
The difference between that and God is that happiness is permanent.
Continues. That's right. Solomon, to be happy, had to keep building. He had to keep trying. He had to build more vineyards. It just went on and on and on and on and on. And when it was all done, he said, I've tried it all and I've done it all. And now it almost seems like there's a step back and it's a matter of, the thought comes to my mind, maybe it's a little bit like he's stopping to smell the roses a little bit. Let me eat some of the grapes from that vineyard. Let me eat a little bit of the fruit from those orchards. And I think that's in part what he's saying to us. I mean, sometimes you can work so hard, you know, trying to make a life, you know, and to make a life for later and for the future. We plan for retirement or whatever. We may not live to retirement. You know, what about just enjoying what you have today? You know, so go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with joy, with a joyful heart, for it is now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in wine and always anoint your head with oil. You know, look up at what you have. There's no reason to be in mourning. You know, again, the idea, I think, here being clothed in white. We don't wear white. I'm wearing the wrong thing today, aren't I? You know, but it's the idea of, I think, being joyful and happy with where you are. Enjoy, like verse 9, it's an interesting point here that he makes. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, and all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. What's the significance of this?
Well, maybe he came to a point where he realized that having one woman that is truly your soulmate, mm-hmm. that God described back in Adam and Eve, that was how God originally intended marriage to be, between one man and one woman. Mm-hmm. You're going to be much better off if you've got that one woman that you love, that you can spend life with, as opposed to having 700 wives and 300 concubines, which are really 1,000 objects. Yeah. They're not soulmates, yeah. They're objects.
Yeah. I wonder which one he called his wife.
He's talking about that one.
Yeah. Again, I'm looking at this as here is his conclusion. Everything he doesn't say, do it like I did. Did you notice that? I mean, there's a lot of things that he has done and tried that he could have said, do it just like I did. I don't remember him saying that.
The opposite most of the time.
I think that's right. I mean, you remember back in chapter 7 when he said in chapter 7, verse 28, while I was still searching but not founding, I found one upright man among 1,000, but none, not one upright woman among them all. Remember we talked about that a little bit? That's kind of struck me funny. Out of 1,000 women, he couldn't find one upright woman. Yes, he happens to have 1,000 wives, so to speak. And it seems to me like he was not happy with not one of them.
He probably never spent a lot of time with him.
I'm sure that's right. But I mean, his simple conclusion, you know, to us, you know, right here is, you know, to enjoy life with your wife whom you love. I think that was the other important part there. The wife whom you love. Not sure how many of those 1,000 women he had that he loved. Enjoy the life with your wife whom you love. How do you do that? I mean, how do you do that?
Maybe it was an observation on his part, not from why we lived, but from David and Bathsheba, his mother.
You know, do you suppose that this king, sitting in this, I keep thinking of kings like sitting in a perch, you know, he can just sit back and he can observe all that's happening in his kingdom. Certainly he has certain memories from his youth. You know, he saw the relationship of David and Bathsheba. He can see others in his kingdom coming and going, and he sees, surely he sees those who are happy with the wife of their youth. You know, he has 1,000 and he hasn't found happiness. And his conclusion here is, you'll find happiness, enjoy your wife. You know, live joyfully, you know, together with her. And in some ways, I almost read it as though this is a time of remorse for him. He's telling us to find and enjoy what he doesn't have.
Well, I think the book of Ecclesiastes, it reminds me that God can take the sin in a person's life and use it to his glory and use it to teach us something.
Yeah.
And he's done that with Solomon. Mm-hmm. He's taking the sin full life that Solomon has lived. And we have the book of Ecclesiastes, which is a comparison between that kind of life under the sun compared to living a life for the Lord. great example for us. I mean, it's, you know, it's just a valuable lesson here for us.
It's like we've talked at times about learning from the mistakes of others. We can learn so much from Solomon that way.
I think about the people that were, you know, the men that were around Solomon that may have been envious of what he had, and maybe they had one woman, and thinking, oh, if I could just be like Solomon and have a thousand.
We have that problem today, don't we? I mean, maybe a man's not wanting a thousand wives, but he wants that one over there. He already has one, but he's not satisfied with that, you know. And good point.
And then look at the other writings of Solomon. It's very interesting to me that he says, "Drink waters from your own cistern, and not another's." And the Song of Solomon is all about this one. Mm-hmm. This one girl that he is in love with, and he looks at her sisters and he looks at others. There's nobody like this one. So the whole idea there is one out of many. There's nobody else that's like this one. Even, and that's taking in consideration his, all of his experience, he still comes back and by inspiration tells us, you know what, the best thing to do is find one good one and marry her
and be satisfied,
love her, and be happy with her the rest of your life.
Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life. The third phrase of that. You know, this life in so many ways can be meaningless, or vanity of vanities, as he would say. Knowing this life is going to come to an end. No matter what you accomplish in this life will come to an end. Something that endures throughout your lifetime is the love that you have for your wife and that relationship. You know, he's finding something, it seems to me, that's kind of solid with that.
Well, obviously, Les mentioned the Song of Solomon, and there are interpretations of the Song of Solomon that state that really the love Solomon had for this woman is unrequited, that she is actually in love with the shepherd. And that Solomon loves her. And I think that almost fits the book a little bit better. And you know, that even makes this more interesting to me, because he's saying, I haven't found that.
Yeah, I could be right. That's right. Kind of different ways of reading the book, Song of Solomon. It's hard to figure that out. But I mean, you can make some really cool applications either way. That's powerful. Good thoughts. I love this part of the book of the Ecclesiastes. As he's drawing these conclusions, he's putting before us here just some simple things that we need to think about. You know, whatever, in verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for in the grave where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. Okay, so should we take that as an uplifting statement, or is it a kind of a black statement? Is it a down statement? I mean, on one hand, you know, get busy, go to work. On the other hand, you know you're going to die. What do you think?
Well, this particular phrase we know is repeated in the New Testament as far as whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. And as unto God.
That's right.
Is what it says. And so we know that whatever we are doing, if it's hammering a nail, or if it's opening up someone's heart and working on it, or it's, you know, painting a picture, whatever it is, we're living our lives and we're doing whatever our particular aptitude or gift is to do. We can be happy and satisfied that we're doing what we should be doing, and that we can enjoy that, and that there's a fulfillment in our lives that relates to our work. We're made to work. Ever see anybody that doesn't ever work? There's kind of a meaningless to that life. You know?
That's right. Powerful statement. Whatever your hands find to do, do it with all your might. You know, to be busy about it, to give everything to what you're doing, what you're focusing on. There's a lot of applications we can make with that. As far as relationships go, relationships with brethren, relationships in the family circle, how we go about our practices at work, you know, what we do. Do it with all your might. I mean, it's very easy, and it seems to be quite common in our day for folks to just kind of glide their way through life, have no ambition, no excitement about anything. In fact, it seems to be somewhat rewarded in our day. But that is so opposite of what Solomon is depicting for us here. And it's opposite of the way he lived his life. I mean, he lived his life with great gusto, we might say. I mean, he was going 110% all the time, you know, exploring, trying new things, experimenting. Which he's not really necessarily telling us to try all that, but whatever your hands find to do, you know, get serious about doing it. And there is application that we can make with that, and some things we need to think about. God willing, Wednesday night, we're going to pick up right there at verse 10. It won't take us too long to get through the rest of the chapter, and so be looking in the chapter 10. It kind of continues on, you know, some good applications, I think, that we can make. Thank you for your comments.